This is a Pinball News production.
Scores for movies by touching buttons, patching cords. But now a new challenge. A pinball manufacturer has asked her to design special sounds for a new game.
Okay, so we're going to start off on the background sound.
A double challenge. Sounds and voices that would play off each other.
I was very interested in getting the whole composition to work, to think of the pinball as actually playing a piece. Because I think to add excitement to the game, that the background sound should speed up as you play the game. So I can put in just a series of pitches. Okay, now I'm going to ask it to play and see what it does here.
The magic sources of these sounds, well, the secret lies in a chip. The chip is a tiny computer program the size of a domino. It stores 48,000 bits of information. When commanded by an outside computer, these bits are spat out rapidly as sound.
The artwork has different phases of transformation.
Chicago, the home office. The sound chips were fun. Now the hard part. A voice chip with something new.
It's a place, it's like a person, it's a state of being, it's a sort of euphoric transformation. And if we could somehow convey all this through the use of voice, we've never done that. It's been so functional and dry before.
I just think it would be really nice to use a female voice in the game as a...
A female voice would tie in great.
Yeah, yeah, for, that, with the voice chip.
That would be unique. Yeah.
Something that hasn't been done before, I don't think.
But it does.
You know, I can process the real voice sound and give it a little bit of a different edge.
An effect? Or?
Yeah, it's like it could go, for instance, even with my voice, the whole gamut of, you know, from male to female even, you know, and everything in between. Hello, hello, hello. One, two, three. Welcome. Welcome.
A female voice in a pinball game. Now, how to fit the sound in a voice chip? Female voices, of a higher frequency than male voices, need almost twice as many bits of information. The chip allows her a total of 5 seconds.
Zena. Zena.
Zena.
Great. So I get this delay. Okay. The idea of using the short grunts and groans came to me when I watched people playing the game. The way that people expressed their frustrations or their involvement with the game. And I wanted the game to do that back. I wanted it to talk back to the people playing.
It'd be good for when they lose the ball.
You know when the ball goes through the tube? Well, how about, you know, I could set it up with my voice saying, try tube shot.
Try tube shot. Try tube shot. Try tube shot. Try tube shot.
It's a kind of emotional let go. You know, when you fall through that tube, you're letting go.
The recorded sounds are analyzed, measured, compressed to fit the chip, then programmed into the chip by computer to interplay with the lights and scores.
Great. Perfect.
Finally, the chips are placed in the pinball machine.
This is our sound chip, and this is our speech.
Great.
Okay, we are all set.
Ready?
Let me close this door. Would you like to move first? Power up.
Power up.
Welcome to Xena.
Well, before working on the game, I must admit I was not much of a pinball player. Of course, now I'm a fanatic.
Sound chips are new. Today we hear Suzanne's voice for 5 seconds. In the future, women with sound chips in their earrings will listen to Beethoven's symphony.
Chips in the 80s, of course, are going to be every place, giving us information, giving us pleasure, getting us excited.
Creating new sounds, disembodied voices, music from instruments that don't exist. This is the power of electricity.
Hi, everybody. I haven't seen that in a long time. A continuation of media clips, I guess. I'm Jim Shelberg, Pin Game Journal, and I just want to say a minute here. I've been trying to get this to happen for probably 10, 12 years now, and it's just I have to say it's really exciting for me. Of course, the sticking point was Suzanne, because she would never come here, and I kept asking her and asking her, and every year. And, I mean, 1 year she had to go score a movie on Mother Teresa instead of... I said, you know, there's a balance. I mean, you know, Mother Teresa at Pinball Expo is like a hard thing to do. But she said, keep asking her, and you never know, she'll accept. And she did this year. And Tom Neiman was gracious enough to fly in from Vegas. And the other two guys are here, but anyway, they just had to drive. The three guys are here. Sorry. So that's all. I just wanted to say that I'm happy about this. I'm glad. And your moderator, famous pinball historian Gary Flower.
Good evening, everyone.
Hello.
Okay. Thank you. Well, we've got a lot to pack into the next hour. We're going to devote it totally to the making of Xenon. We have a very stellar cast. I'm just going to set some background and tell you that the game design process started in about the end of 79, and the game finally made it onto the streets towards the end of 1980. And I think 11,000 units were made in total. So without further ado, I'd like to bring on the stars of the show one at a time. I'm going to start with Greg Kamek. Can you come up, please? Greg's background as a designer at Bally. Alan, can you join us, please? Alan was an engineer at Bally. Did some very interesting stuff in the NT department, which is new technology, if you have a chance to talk to him later. And Tom, can you come and join us, please? Tom had been with Bally a few years by the time this project started, and I think your title was Vice President of Marketing?
I don't remember.
All right. And finally, Suzanne. Sorry, Paul. Paul's responsible for the stunning artwork on this game. And Paul. Anne-Marie Suzanne. That's great. And Suzanne, who's made it over here from the West Coast. Suzanne's going to tell us how she did the sound and speech. So I think that's introductions. Tom, can I hand over to you now to get into a level of detail about how this project all started?
Good evening, everyone. My name's Tom Neiman. My association with this at the time, I was responsible for a lot of the marketing and all the licensing at Bally Pinball. As some of you may know, we had started off not knowing what the hell we were doing when we were going out and getting licenses, starting with Pinball Wizard, Captain Fantastic, and on and on and on, Evel Knievel, etc. Xenon is an unusual opportunity because it was a game that didn't come with an immediate brand identity. We didn't have a movie, we didn't have a celebrity, we didn't have a rock star or whatever behind it. So it's an original game. What we did have is a star of another kind. Instead of buying a brand in what we referred to as the first quarter, when we put out those big branded games and had so much success, simple to get the first quarter. It took guys like Greg Kamik and the Playfield designers to get the second quarter, the third quarter. It took artists like Paul Ferris and his entire staff that had this dramatic artwork that blended with those licensed games and truly delivered the sense of the persona or whatever the brand license was. With Xenon, unique. We didn't have that instant identity. So we didn't have that first quarter feature. To bring that to life was the concept of, beyond doing it visually, what can we do with sounds? And in those days, it was a very crude stage, sound-wise. We had a firm that we did a great deal of promotional work with. A firm was called The Response Group, TRG, out of New York City. They worked with me on a few different projects. I don't know if anyone remembers our attempt at a world pinball championship that we did at the Playboy Towers. And I'm not even sure what the year of it was, but worked with TRG. And so I was on the phone with them quite a bit looking for and trying to create new promotional ideas and concepts. We were into this subject of audio and sound and what's going on, and it was TRG that introduced me to the name Suzanne Ciani. And they gave me some very preliminary contact information. And at some point I reached out, called Suzanne's office, and was fortunate enough to get a call back. I guess the concept of, I mean, here's someone doing movie soundtracks and Grammy-nominated music, and I'm talking about a pinball machine. Well, we were very, very fortunate enough that I think at that point in time in American culture, pinball was hot. It was the pre-video revolution. And so the idea of pinball, which was clear because I'm still not sure why people like Evel called me back or Elvis. I've chased them all as I went down my fantasy list of who I wanted to meet. And most of them called back with some level of interest. So Suzanne and her office did respond. I reached out, contacted. We had a preliminary discussion on what we were thinking of. And things all sort of come together from various points. You've got whiteboards in development, Greg and his group doing their thing, Paul always having ideas about artwork and directions to go. You know, one might think that the artist always wanted to have the next big licensed game, but the reality of it is a game like Xenon truly let them be creative. It gave them a blank canvas and allowed them to create what their image was. So Paul had some ideas, and Paul and I talked constantly about what's next, where we go, what we do. And this meeting in New York City with Suzanne came up, and I flew out there, and the very first meeting with Suzanne at her studio was her apartment. And, the Midwestern Chicago kid goes into the big city, and I found it. And we had this great meeting, and since I had called her, she had gone out to do her own market research. She had gone to the Broadway Arcade and watched players and to see what was going on in the games at that point, at that stage, and then, of course, let her do her thing, her creativity of where could I take it, what direction could I go in. And so that was all these elements coming together from dramatic whiteboard, some thoughts about themes, and Paul always had in his vision how he would carry out a theme. And it was, if I remember correctly, it was Paul who named it. I remember him coming to me with this name, Xenon. And I said, what the hell's a xenon? And that's when I discovered it's a gas. And it was a gas, if I remember, it was a gas that was used in neon. And I think the neon and the tube and everything played together, but I'm sure these people can explain it much more. All I stood back is let very smart, creative, talented people do very smart, creative, and talented things. And I was brilliant enough never to get in their way, just to say yes. And that's what my meeting with Suzanne was like in New York, where she talked to me about what they did, and she tried to explain to me how she created the sounds. And I'm a marketing guy. I have no idea what she said. How she did it, how it works, it was way beyond me, but I just could tell this was someone who was incredibly talented. Yes, you could look at her resume and see this is a person with an unbelievable amount of skills and talent. And again, my brilliance was getting out of her way and saying yes to everything she wanted to do. So with that, I guess that sets it up, and I don't know where you want me to punt it to.
Can I hand over to Greg now, and can you tell us about how you went about designing the playfield, please?
You want us to use these?
Fine.
Okay. Well, very briefly, I'll run through the story of Xenon as a whitewood. I was walking through a store one day, and I saw a cylindrical plastic tube about 4 feet in length, and I picked it up, and I said, wouldn't this be kind of cool to have a pinball go through here? At the time, all the games were single level, so I spent the weekend back at Bally tearing apart a cabinet and lowering a playfield 3 or 4 inches to accommodate the tube over the playfield. And after that, the initial name of the game was called Saber Dance, where you have the xenon lights in the center. We, at the time, were always using white or yellow inserts, and we were always chasing Williams at the time because they were snazzing up their games. So I decided to use amber, which historically was used for extra ball, and blue, which transparent, which was kind of historically used for double bonus. So I just threw them in the play field where the game was called Saber Dance. When I was done with the Whitewood playfield, still called Saber Dance, it was approved for percentaging. And at that point, the game was given to the art department, still called Saber Dance. And that's when Paul got his hands on it, and the rest is history. So that's my contribution.
Thank you very much, Greg. So I guess, Paul, it turns up at the art department. What happens next?
Well, I remember when I went in and looked at the Whitewood, initially I was, this was such a futuristic looking game with this tube on it. We hadn't seen anything quite like that before. And I don't remember this exactly correctly chronologically, but I don't remember if we knew for sure that this was going to have the female voice yet. I think we were, still that was being discussed, and it was a great idea, but we didn't know if it was going to be able to happen. So I kind of worked on the play field first and came up with just a very futuristic city or civilization. I didn't try to be... Sometimes when we had a non-licensed game, we would kind of create our own mythology for the game. So when I did Paragon, I had a whole storyline in mind of the characters. And so I didn't have so much of that with Xenon because it was... we were still kind of evolving it. But I just wanted to capture this very futuristic-looking... graphics. Then when we knew it was going to be a female voice and it was blessed to go, and I heard Suzanne's voice and coming with some of the sounds that she had created. I wanted to create this the Xenon woman. And because, again, we decided to put an infinity box treatment on the back glass that we had used in the game prior to that, in Space Invaders, to give it sort of a snazzy sort of futuristic effect, and also to kind of create the illusion of a tube, to kind of accentuate that. And after, but then by doing the infinity effect, you don't have a lot of extra room to do. I used to love to put a lot of artwork in the glasses, and there really isn't that much room to do it. So what I wanted to do was create this very highly evolved woman of Xenon that, and this was, you know, quite a few years ago, as you all know. And this, but my vision was this 8 foot tall, blue skinned woman with large eyes. And this is way before Avatar. And but the one thing I wanted to make sure was clear was we used to sometimes get a little grief from a variety of people about having women on our games that were sort of in subservient roles and sort of, you know, and so I wanted there to be no mistaking that that Xenon woman was not a subservient woman, but she had this wonderful voice, and there's the author right next to me, that was just spectacular. So that was really the whole key, was just trying to come up with a woman that and it's not any particular people. I've been known to use other people on as my models. In this case, it was just from my head. But this sort of highly evolved, highly intelligent, you know, large woman that would utter these wonderful sounds was my plan.
That's how I described Suzanne to you.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what he said she looked like when he came back from New York. No. So that was my, again, that was my contribution. But I have to be honest and pay props to Greg. When I went in and saw that Whitewood, I definitely wanted to do the artwork on it. And this was before, you know, sometimes you'd have to assign games to certain artists as they became available, and we were doing a lot of games at the time. but that one I really did want to do, and the fact that it would have its own theme to it, its own storyline, and then it became even, you know, more interesting as this became the first talking female game. So I love that game, and you know, the way the game plays is certainly extremely important, but I love working on the package too. So
thank you very much, Paul. Can we go back to you, Greg, and ask you about the multiple feature on that game?
Okay. So the artwork's done, the game's complete as a single ball game. And we're playing it as a single ball game, we're percentaging it, and you'll notice that these lights that talk about multi-ball and the multi-ball capture, if there's a ball in here, the switch had to be added. This was all done after the artwork was done, after the fact. So the story about that is, artwork's done, we're percentaging the game as a single ball game. My friend Alan Reisman, who worked in the electronics department, everybody went out to lunch, and Alan stayed in, and he threw two balls on the play field just to see what it was like, and I'll let him pick up the story from there.
Well, thanks for that. What he doesn't tell you is I've been trying to get multi-ball in the games for 2 years. I would field a lot of calls from, at that time, collecting games was in its infancy, and I would get a call from a lot of collectors saying, how do I get my my 4 million BC working? How do I get my Fireball? Everybody wanted those games because they were the original multi-balls, and we had just gone away from that technology. So I did that with every game that came into the lab. I wait till nobody was around. Hey, what would happen if I put a second ball in play? Oh, look at that. And then they'd come back from lunch, and they'd go, get out of here. So I'd take that ball off the field. Well, in the case of Xenon, it actually played better as a multi-ball game. I had it in the lab, and I was doing some work on the sound. We were finishing up the sound, trying to get the old Talking Kiss sound system compressed into something sellable. So I was testing that out, and I'm always around, put the second ball in play. Hey, this is great. I'm sitting there playing that, and some of the other engineers go in and say, hey, this is cool. Let me have a shot at that. And there comes Greg in, and I grab him, and I say, hey, check this out. He looks at it. Oh, that's pretty good. He disappears, comes back with, I think Did you come back with Tom or Norm? All of a sudden, before I know it, all the engineers are scrambling. We got to reprogram the software. We got to put all these new assemblies in. We got to make this a multi-ball game because this Reisman guy just suddenly put a second ball on the playfield, and darn it, it actually plays better. And that was how that came about. We did that, I think, in a weekend. We made that transition over the weekend because the game was due to go to production like within the next couple weeks.
The game was already done?
Yep.
Okay. Thanks for that, Alan. Susan, can I ask you a question? When you first saw the game, at what stage was its development?
As I recall, I went to Chicago, and I went to the Bally office, factory, headquarters, and I was taken around to the various departments. I remember being taken to the art department. And of course, I was, being a woman, I was a little bit like aghast at the, you know, the image of the female that was portrayed in most pinball games. You know, it's a, kind of a man's world. And but you know, it was fine. I adapted. I mean, over the years, I've really learned to appreciate what that world was, and especially being here just for this convention and sharing with all of you, you know, the total passion that goes on in this field and your attention to detail and history and the whole organic evolution of this world, this very special world. You know, I have a new appreciation after all this time, really, of what was going on then. At that time, it was the first time I'd ever seen anything like it. I didn't know what I was seeing. I remember seeing drawings, and I said, what, this is art? And I said, I didn't know what it was. And then I went back at a certain point to work with the sound programmer. And, you know, everybody was so clear. You know, the reason that I was able to do what I did coming in from, you know, left field, so to speak, was that, you know, I was in the hands of people who communicated very clearly what was needed. And, you know, I didn't know about all the levels of gratification, you know, that went on and how you had to build the emotions and reward system. I mean, my pinball playing never got past, you know, the very lowest stage. So I never got to any of those higher levels. I didn't know they were there. So that they were very gentle with me and told me how it, you know, had to go. And so I got all the support I needed to do that. I adapted, right? I adapted. And, you know, they, as Tom said, I mean, the beauty is that he did give creative freedom. And to me, this is the most important thing. Because when you're working from your gut and you're working from your instinct and you're just coming from the excitement of creation, you don't want something that comes in the way of that and short circuits it in any way. And he, you know, is a perfect person to work for because he allowed all the, you know, my natural ideas to kind of just come forth. It also helps that when you're working in the field that I worked in, a lot of people don't understand it anyway, you know, so you have a lot of freedom because it's like, you know, you dazzle them with the wires and the, you know, and the computers. And so, you know, I was always lucky in New York to have freedom in the work I did. But did I answer the question?
You did, very eloquently.
Okay.
Can I ask you now, don't put the microphone down, I'm going to ask you to now go on to the next level of detail and tell us how you went about developing the sounds, and perhaps you can use the equipment to demonstrate that.
Oh, yeah. Well, first I'd like to just say that, you know, as a composer, I always think analytically about the architecture and the structure and all the elements of sound and composition. So when you have a background sound and it has to endure for a long time, you want to make something that is, you know, not too static. And that's why, it's funny, last night, Chris Graner was giving a talk, and he was telling about how he had discovered this diminished chord and that he used that in a lot of his sound. Well, I actually used that also instinctively. I used a tritone relationship because it made it a little bit less stable and gave a momentum to the background sound. Then my idea was, as also Chris noticed, is that what's happening in the pinball game is that the composition is being created in the process of playing. So you want sounds that are going to add to each other and overlap in musical ways. And so the other sounds are all designed to fit, architecturally with that bottom sound. So harmonically, melodically, rhythmically, whatever. So you get this sense of a wholeness when you're playing the game. It's a complete sound environment as opposed to something that's like attacking you from different directions. So that was my thought process. I went back and forth with Bali on a bunch of sounds. And do you really want to hear some of those sounds?
While Suzanne's getting ready, if I can just mention a couple of things. Suzanne mentioned the software guy she was working with. I believe, gentlemen, that would probably have been Riemann Mergent. Is that correct? Right. And in fact, in the video that was playing before we started talking, you see him placing the sound chip into the game. So there's one item for you. And just, I guess, to put this into a historical context compared to where we are today, I'm going to guess that in that year, sort of 79-80, Bally, Williams and Gottlieb combined probably brought out maybe a dozen different games. And this particular game sold 11,000 units. In the last 12 months, I would bet money the industry hasn't made 12,000 units of pinball. So just in one game, 11,000 units, more than a year's production for the last 12 months. Have we got any questions while Suzanne's getting ready? Dave.
I need help with recalling a bit of pop culture from the time, because that was right about the time that I think there's a famous nightclub in New York called Xenon that was supposed to be the next thing after Studio 54. Does anyone recall that?
I remember that.
I can tell you that there was...
Dan remembers it. There was a Xenon club, and I don't remember the timing relative to this game, but it was a fortunate thing for the game that became a hot club.
More fortunate.
There was no Google back then, so you just made up a name and you crossed your fingers and nobody else had it first. Today, you would probably go on the internet, type it into Google, and see who else has it.
I can mention also there was a Xenon club in London at the time as well.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's the alternative
name was Avatar.
Giant blue lady. That was
giant. Oh boy.
Yeah, what's this? Sound added to the game,
a
male voice?
Oh, yeah. I mean, and now that we're all together here, 30-some years later, I've always wondered why there was that male voice that said, enter Xenon. You know, because there was one... I mean, I was going, welcome to Xenon. You know, and then there was this very dry male voice that would enter Xenon, and Tom doesn't even know where that came from, do you?
No, I thought it was part of the original package.
No.
Where that it was not in your package. I don't know who would have had access.
Yeah.
One of the
sound guys.
To do the programming.
That's a mystery that somebody has to uncover. Right. Somebody. I always thought it was Tom. But I just had, you know, I found... I went into my vault and I found just some old tape boxes that said Xenon sounds. And I have some of those here. And I'm not sure if these, I think a lot of these were outtakes. Some of them were used. By the way, I want to tell you, you know, you saw that video, the film that was made, a documentary about my work in this game. And it shows, it opens up with, I'm working at an instrument called a synclavier. This was a $200,000, you know, early digital instrument that I used to replicate this 15-cent chip, you know? So, and that's what it took. I mean, I did a lot of jobs with the synclavier. I did a sound that AT&T is still using for the telephone. And I could go in with that instrument and, you know, extract frequencies, you know, that would have triggered numbers on the telephone. I mean, it's very surgical what you can do with that, what I could do with that instrument. I don't have it anymore. But at that time, I had the luxury, because I talked to, you know, Chris last night, and he was saying how he had to work, you know, at by typing in numbers, waiting for the thing to process, and then listening. And I was able to, with this machine that I had, really just define the parameters that were available to me, and then just work within that frame instantly. So it was kind of a luxury that I had at that time.
What's the name of the machine?
It was called a Synclavier, S-Y-N-C-L-A. It was made by New England Digital. Yeah, in Vermont, and that. Yeah, and they're kind of Dartmouth College, which is a center for digital. The other advantage I had was that I had studied computer music with Max Matthews, who is the father of computer music, and I went to Stanford for a whole semester working with Max and John Chowning, who is the fellow that, you know, came upon frequency modulation as we know it in musical instruments. So I had a good background for understanding chip level work. You know, today the whole world is different. I don't think you have to maximize, you know, as much as you did then. And I really liked that challenge, you know, for me, because I had a high tech mentality. Being challenged was, you know, with the forefront and being on the very edge. That was where I liked to live, you know. I wanted to do the first of everything. So here are a couple of other sounds. Another thing that I just, you know, that I realized in listening back to some of these sounds is that, you know, when you play pinball, it's always this up and down. The ball goes up, the ball comes down. You know, it's this kind of pulsing motion. And the sounds, you know, all reflect that. They're either kind of going up or they're coming down, or, you know, the background is more steady. So I think that the shape of the sounds is definitely something that's, you know, a DNA for pinball. I don't think that one was used. No. That one was used, yeah. That was the tilt? Okay. Wow.
How's this? They're shooting at you from the front and the back. For someone who lived in what I would envision as such a structured, analytical world, the chaos or the randomness of a pinball machine. Never plays the same way twice.
Right.
Every ball, the patterns, the movement. There's no way to know this sound's going to follow this sound or this sound's going to build on this sound. With the randomness, and I'll use that word, did it, and once you went into the arcade, saw this randomness take place, was that at all troubling? Was it a challenge? Is it unique from the world that you lived in, or ultimately it's consistent with the world that you were living in, the more structured music soundtrack world?
No, it was unique. It was a challenge. It was wonderful. It was a whole new compositional paradigm, you know, to have a composition that was generated randomly.
User-generated.
Yeah, user-generated.
Which sound was going to follow was based on how did you move the ball?
Yeah. No, it's a wonderful approach to piece. But, you know, for years before, I mean, I had, before I did this commercial work, I had years as a pure artist where I was playing live electronic music with a bukla. So it was a non-keyboard instrument with knobs and dials, and you would perform by doing a choreography of movements and patching. So you were live patching these modules. So it was a modular synthesizer. And they still exist today, and there's actually, you know, kind of a renaissance now. The kids are very excited about those early analog modular instruments. So, you know, that world was a little bit chaotic and pure electronic. And the bukla was my instrument. So that was the one.
Ow.
Ah.
Ow.
Xenon.
I don't think we use that.
Xenon.
No.
Xenon.
This went on for weeks. It drove us crazy.
Xenon?
I don't think we use that, no.
Was that last sound representing what you said on the film about male voice?
Yes.
Play it one more time.
Yes. Let me just go back a little ways, see where it is.
Oh, 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 oh!
Let me go down.
Oh, 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 oh!
Oh, 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 oh!
So I had something called a voice box, which was, you see it in that movie, it was a horizontal cabinet with a lot of rack-mounted units that were all connected, and I could very quickly, you know, it was all for voice processing, but I had compressors and filters and harmonizers and vocoders and all kinds of gadgets for modulating my voice. And so this particular thing was done with an eventide harmonizer, and I actually have one of those here. I don't know if this is going to work, though. Let me see. Are we on? Let me see.
Hello? Hi. Yes, I know. Well, it's hard to be in a man's world. Sometimes I just don't feel they understand me. But this is actually Steve. And I actually have my own recording career. And I hope you'll listen to some of it later. And then, but with this, for instance,
what's
Fanny?
face. I know, I'm so shy. But anyway.
Yeah, but you know, you have to do these things with a degree of like, here's the other thing about making sounds that are going to last. They do have to be kind of perfect, so you can't just toss them off. I mean, you really have to polish them the same way they polished everything else in this machine. The artwork, you know, all the gaming, the programming, everything was done, you know, with that kind of something that would last. So anyway, thanks.
Thank you. Okay, we have some time for questions and answers. Martin.
The French version of Xenon has a male voice, which is very, very bad. It's just the most crappiest voice ever.
The French always want something unique and different. Georges Santamaria, who ran Ballet France, huge buyer. I can't imagine, I mean, he would have no access to change the voice. So are you telling me all the machines that went into France had a different voice?
Quite sure, because I fixed many for these French people. I fixed the games and programs
Sure, that's what they want.
They would make their own changes in France. They had their own equipment. And they would change their own, do their own audio program.
Ballet France, you're telling me Ballet France had the ability to alter this audio for the game?
Yes, they would create their own programs.
It's too bad that I did not bring it because it's so bad. It's just incredible.
George's sons are still alive, and I think in the business, I see them occasionally, Frank and Christophe, and I will reprimand them. They must have knocked it off, because the French would get some of the very earliest shipments, so they could sell them into Germany first and get the most money, and then they'd fill their own backyard. So we were constantly negotiating that little battle. But I know of absolutely no conscious authorization so that they would, the only thing along that lines I know of is graphically, and that was on the KISS game where the SSs were changed. Imagine that. To the soft S, not the hard S.
Okay, next question. Over there, gentleman in the hat.
For Suzanne, when you were recording all the sounds and such,
Well, all the sounds that I did were within the parameters of the chip, so I knew they would work in the chip. So I just replicated the chip in my computer, and so all my sounds would go right in. The voice, I had limitations on the amount of space. I can't remember how. It was not big, so thus a lot of those short, punchy voice sounds. And that was a strict sampling, so I just had to be very aware of the time, you know, that everything would fit on the chip.
The things that we've heard that did you go in and try those and say this doesn't work, or did you?
Oh, try them in the game?
Yeah, were you?
No. So, I just did it by imagination.
So you kind of had a composition and then took it in and gave it to them, and that was it.
Yeah, I had sounds for the things that they wanted. You know, they said, now we need a disappointing sound that's this long or about this long, you know, that means this. Or, you know, now we need a sound for when they launch the ball. And so I would look at a game and see how long it took to launch a ball and, you know.
Most of the disappointing sounds came out of the competitors, though, once this game came out.
Okay, gentleman in the blue shirt.
How long did it take for you to do your work?
Me?
Yeah. How long did it take for you to do your work? How many months?
Oh, months. I didn't do anything over months. I had ran an emergency room. That's what I called it in New York. People would call, and they needed something the next day. And if somebody called and said, we'd like to book you for next week, I'd say, well, call back when you're ready. You know? It's like, so I was used to this incredible intensity in production, and I had a good staff.
Long hours.
Yeah, it was done pretty quickly.
Can I ask a question here?
Yes, this question is, I guess, largely for Suzanne, but it maybe the entire team as well. Every once in a while, there's a pinball machine, or very rarely there's a pinball machine, that starts something that every pinball machine after that copies. Like, for instance, I think of High Speed with the habit trails that bring the ball back to the flippers. And after watching this, which I've seen many times before, and after comments that you know, my wife and I make when we play our pinball machines at home, I believe it's possible that you guys have a first with Xenon, which is that sound when the ball goes in the out lane that everybody makes. And I know that you did that consciously. And ever since then, every game that we play that has sound includes that type of a sound. Was that something you guys were aware of? And Suzanne, do you know that you probably started that?
Which sound was that?
So the sound when the ball goes out the out, when it's draining, when it goes out the out lane. And you mentioned that you consciously came up with that sound, that grunt that's disappointing. Every game today has that sound. I mean, it's their own version of that sound, but it's that concept.
That's very cool. See, I would never have known that since I only know one game.
Does everybody agree with me on that? Do you know the sound that we're talking about? And it just occurred to me that this was the first game that did that.
Wow, thank you for that.
Was that conscious? Did you guys?
It started with games like Rolling Stone and a few others where they, Kiss I believe had that, where they actually tried to put a custom sound to the outline. It's just that on Xenon, we had such a good library of unique sounds to work with, but the idea of customizing a sound to a particular ball position, we actually started that back when Rolling Stones came out, and I think Kiss may have been the first game to have a customized outhole sound.
Got another question here.
I've got a question for Martin in Germany. You had mentioned something about the voice work being a man's voice. Was the choreography and the voice, was it all the same, but just a different voice? Okay.
Not only on Xenon, also for Flash Gordon, for example, they did the same.
Okay. We have a local operator that's a pinball repair guy that's been in the business for, I don't know, probably 30 years. And he had a Squawk and Talk game. I don't remember what game it was, 8-Ball Deluxe or something like that, but it used the Squawk and Talk game. And he had one that had a weird pitched voice in it as well. And what he found on it, on the Squawk and Talk game, was there was I don't know what exactly the position of it was on the board, but one of the capacitors had a different value on it, which gave it a different pitch. He corrected that capacitor on that Squawk and Talk game, and it fixed the problem. So I'm just
wondering. He thought he had a rare collectible there, did he?
Yeah.
Okay. Can I ask Paul a question? When you were doing the original art for Xenon, particularly the back glass, what media were you using?
What
media were you using?
That's actually primarily acrylic airbrush. I mean, I use a lot of airbrush on that piece. And,
okay. And where is that today, that original piece?
The original piece, actually the one that's here, is not the original. It's a translator of the original. I pulled the original painting out to bring to the this fine event tonight. And I've been here before and I've talked about this, but there was a period of time when we had moved into new offices at Bally Midway. And my office wasn't even set up yet. I just had taken several of the original pinball paintings and leaned them up against the wall, getting ready to store them in the flat files when they were going to be brought into my office. This was over the Christmas period, so very cold. They had the sprinkling system in the new office froze because the heat went off, broke, flooded the offices, and several of those pieces that were on the floor got wet up to about 3 inches up the painting. And I was going to bring the painting today because it still exists. It's still fine except the lower 3 inches of it has to be kind of relaminated very carefully, and there wasn't really time to do that. But so I still have the original Xenon, and it looks very similar to this. It's a little bit larger than the Translite is there. But luckily, I mean, nothing has disturbed the, because it was acrylic, which is a good thing, nothing disturbed the paint itself. It's just that it's, because it was done on a piece of illustration board, it's all laminated paper on top of cardboard, and it's just kind of delaminated. So I'm going to actually take the time to fix that now that I realize that that has, it's actually gotten a little bit more delaminated over time from being stored. So that's the one reason I didn't want to take the chance of taking it out.
Okay. Have you seen the drawing of Xenon that's in the hallway?
Yes, I have. I actually did that drawing, and that's the first sketch I did to kind of create the woman of Xenon. And I was sort of surprised. I think it was two years ago when I was sitting at the autograph session, a gentleman came up and had a T-shirt with that artwork on it, and I'm thinking the whole time that drawing is in my flat file in my studio. And what happened was that when I left Bally, I took quite a bit of the work with me, but some of that was left in cabinets that I think eventually this particular gentleman bought a lot of that work, and that was one of the pieces in there. And it's just on a piece of tracing paper that when I designed the first face for Xenon, and that's so to see it coming back and see it on a T-shirt that I didn't know that somebody else had that artwork, so I went back and looked in my drawers, and sure enough, he had it.
So. Can I ask that next time you pass that piece, can you autograph it for us so that we can put it in the charity auction on Saturday night?
The one that's, do we mean the poster, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Thanks very much for that. Okay, more questions from the floor. Dave again.
This is probably for Greg, and you can toss it whichever way you have to. This is more of a detailed question about the sound. So we heard in the documentary that there was 5 seconds. I've got all the speech calls here. Who would handle the cutting and pasting kind of thing? You've got Xenon 2, and then there's Xenon Exit 1, Exit 2. So there's a possibility of reusing syllables there. Did you have Suzanne do that? Did you do that? The sound guy? How did you work out cramming in by reusing the syllables?
Well, with only 5 seconds available, that question can be answered by Al, the technical guy.
So we had, you all know, Ray Merchant headed up the project, and there was another engineer there, Bob Cohan. And Bob and Ray? It's kind of funny. They literally locked themselves in a room and figured out what would go in and what would go out. So we had this library of sounds. We chopped it up into pieces. And if it didn't fit, they sped it up. And if it sounded cool, slow down, they would slow it down. But they did all that. You wouldn't even use the terms cutting and pasting in those days. I don't know what they would call it, but that's Bob and Ray probably did all that editing and compressing.
Did you have the ability to play it back at more than one speed, so one cut could be used at both slow and fast?
Yeah, the synthesizer, this was very common. A lot of the sounds in games, if you slow them down, they turn out to be public domain tunes. if you ever were to do that, you know how you play a record backwards and you hear, you know, Bally sucks, but whatever. Bally's great. But yeah, it's very similar. They had the sounds programmed in, and you could play them back at any tempo, any compression you want, and you could turn a sound into something completely unrecognizable.
Thank you.
While you're talking about the speech that went into the game, I've got something that, Tom, you may not be aware of, but I think round about the time Xenon was being developed, you got a new secretary. Is that correct? A young lady goes by the name of Andy?
Yeah.
Andy Sucre. Okay, well, Andy Sucre is now Andy Freres. She married Greg Freres. And from her, she tells me that she just started as Bally, as Tom's secretary. And one of the first jobs she had to do as a secretary was take dictation. And somehow, she had to find a way of recording on paper all the oohs and ahs that were going to be passed to Suzanne to go into the machine. And at that stage, she wondered what crazy kind of a business she got into, and she wasn't sure if it was something she wanted to stay at. Okay.
Tom? Actually, Andy asked me, she thought that you might have done that on purpose.
As sort of a test.
As a test, right, for the new girl.
So that, we've got time for one or two more questions.
I got one. Paul, this game actually was loaned to us by Rob Hoffman. He's back there. And by the way, I want to thank him for that. It's a good-looking example.
Nice job.
Wonderful restoration.
But it's fitted, at least in the back glass, with color-changing LEDs. And I'm curious, from an art standpoint and maybe design standpoint, what you guys think of the newer things that have been put into games like that.
I know I like the package. I hadn't seen it for a while, so just the package was very was nice to see again. So, but I where you're talking about the
eyes?
Oh yeah. Interesting. I never want to mess with the artwork, but I think that's an interesting touch, and I like it. I mean, the whole idea, as you can tell, was to add as much glitter into the game and as much attention-grabbing information as we could. So that was why, with all the lighting that was created there, was trying to create this dazzling effect. But nicely done. This package is beautiful, though. It's a restored package, and it's beautiful.
This is for all of you. Can we know where you're at now? You know, where you work, what do you do now?
Okay, well, I'm working on computers and working in radio, ham radio.
I'm still a computer engineer. When I got married, my wife made me go out and get a real job.
Superstar.
Nothing's changed.
I in 2002... I went back into education, which I started out at before I went to Bally. And I have, I still do artwork, but I now have, it's the most wonderful experience in the world, working with young kids and sort of being the magician that can share all these tricks with these young kids who are very interested in doing artwork. And I'm the department chairman for two large high schools south of here in New Lenox, Illinois. And I plan to do this until I get tired of it, and so far it's been wonderful. So it's been a great experience.
I left Chicago 20 years ago. I moved out to Las Vegas to work for Bally out there. And then have since today, I'm vice president of global marketing for a firm called JCM Global. It's a Japanese-owned company, and it provides all the currency validation, transaction monitoring software. It's all the getting the cash in and out of a casino in the quickest, most efficient way. In the most secure way.
Okay. Thanks for that. Greg, I think you've got something you want to say.
As a final point, I want to bring up the fact that, although we mentioned the game going from a Whitewood to the art department to Suzanne through Al, this seems to me to be the first example of what we now call a team concept game. Prior to this, the designers would design a game, give it to the art department, and it was a very quick turnaround, a very quick way to get a game onto the market. Because at that point, the game, we were making several models a year, so we needed a quick turnaround. But this being a team concept game, probably the first one that I've run across, the Whitewood was done by me, and then the artwork was done by Paul, and Al got involved changing it to multi-ball, and thank goodness Suzanne got involved and put the final touches on the game. I know I appreciate all the effort of everybody that contributed to the game, but especially I want to say one last thing. From being at Bally, say from the mid-70s to the mid-80s, the two most important people at Bally weren't Greg Kamik or Jim Patla. The two most important people at Bally, and it shows because they started the team game concept, were Tom Neiman and Paul Ferris.
Yeah.
we should have been paid more.
Okay. I'd like to end by thanking Greg Kmet for giving us the game design, Alan for the technology and the multi-ball, Paul for the stunning artwork, Tom for bringing it all together and making it happen, and the voice of Suzanne Ciani, the voice of Xenon.